Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your solo host today, Monica Hadley, and with me on Writers' Voices is Peter Himmelman, author of Suspended by No String. Now, Peter is a well-known songwriter, Grammy and Emmy Award nominated rock and roll performer, songwriter, film composer, visual artist, and award-winning author. He's been profiled in Time Magazine, Rolling Stone, The Wall Street Journal, NPR, and now Writers' Voices.
This is it.
Yeah. Founded in 2011, his company Big Muse has worked with organizations such as the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan, and many others to help leaders become more resilient, more trusting, and more willing to manifest their authentic selves. And I'd really love to hear more about that, as well as this wonderful book. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Peter.
Thank you. I was excited when I got the notice on this thing. I love it. It's great.
So tell us about Suspended by No String. It didn't end up being the book that it started out to be, as I understand.
That's true. Now, in 2016, there was a book published on one of the Penguin imprints called Let Me Out. It had a very clear conceit and had a very clear purpose. The conceit was, how does somebody, let's say a person who's striving to be creative, or aren't we all, how does somebody take the fruits of their imagination and actually manifest them, as opposed to some idea just slides away? And I thought the book did pretty well, and I used it with some of the organizational work that I do. And I thought, well, I'll make a follow-up book to that, which I've learned is not a great idea. So I worked on that book for about 2 years, and you know, it wasn't bad. I finished manuscript, but I didn't love it. When I write a song, it doesn't come out into the world unless I can see nothing wrong with it. It just seems like a whole finished something. There's nothing that bothers me, and I couldn't really figure out what was bothering me. So I sent it to this wonderful editor. Her name is Barbara Clark, and I just got a hold of her by some, you know, providential circumstances. And she read the manuscript, and she had read the entirety of my book, Let Me Out, and she sent me back, you know, a 15-page single space treatise on the book. And about three quarters of the way through, she said, look, you know, it's not to me a book about creativity. You've already done that, and you've done it pretty well. This seems to be a book about spirituality. And you know, I'm sure you've had this experience where one sentence can just crack open an entire world. You know, it was such a liberating thing that she said. So I worked on a book in the same sort of prescriptive nonfiction format as Let Me Out, and in the space of something having to do with spirituality, which is now seems to me an absurdity to try to do something like that. And it also became a finished manuscript. And I was about to send it out, you know, and it still didn't feel right. So I sent Barbara Clark this other piece that I had that was just sort of, I didn't know if anyone would care for it at all. It was called Suspended by No Strings, about a 1,200 word piece. It's not long. She took an inordinately long time to get back to me. And she wrote, I hesitate to say this, but what you've sent now is one of the most beautiful things I've read in many years. And it touched me deeply. And drum roll, if you have more like this, I suggest you dump everything you've done before. And funny, rather than that being dismaying to me, it was another much higher level of liberation. Because then there were no purposes to what I was writing. It was simply the way that I write songs, which are exclusively for myself. you know, there is a hope that someone else will approve of them or listen to them. I write really for myself and maybe two or three other people. I think of them and how they would react. But I wouldn't say, you know, writing any kind of book is effortless, but there was something proximate to effortlessness once I got to that place where I'm just going to write what I feel like.
Okay, so we're so all of these pieces other than that one were written for the book, or did you gather things that you had written before?
Some were older. There's a couple things that I have been kind of sketching out since 2008. A lot, I would say the bulk of them were new. And sometimes I would wake up, you know, when you wake up in the morning and you're kind of in that liminal state between your last dream and the really before you've arisen to consciousness. There was a lot of a lot of that, and I do that all the time. I tend not, it's not about laziness, I just sort of like that space. So then I would kind of write down an idea and wake up and have some eggs and then flesh it out. There's a lot of that. There's a friend of mine, a close friend, that was going through a horrible medical journey. And some of the things that I wrote with him in mind. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would send him things just to kind of, I don't know what, just so we could enter some sort of communion over the digital wire together through these little pieces.
In some ways, it seems like this book is almost a spiritual memoir.
I wouldn't think that that's too far off in a certain way.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not a, I once started working on a memoir and just thought memoir requires that somebody, you know, had a horrible experience.
Doesn't it though?
No. I mean, it's sort of that we have the readership has a prurient interest in our horrible things. I mean, I do recount in some detail some very tragic things that happened to me, but I was raised by a beautiful family. I have loving friends. You know, I didn't have a horrible addiction or anything. So writing a memoir just didn't make sense. I don't think that I'm that interesting, you know, to write about. But this could be said to be like that, like a, you know, here's my accounts of some reckonings that I've had.
And awakenings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So describe to us how you organized the book and how you came up with that structure.
Yeah. You know, since there's no linear form, it's not a novel by any means. These are pieces of various lengths. I sort of say in my introduction, they're similar to my songs at different tempos and different colors. So I thought it would be a good idea to kind of arrange them. And at some moment, I just thought I'm going to make them into three or four parts. The first part is astonishments, which I, you know, sort of think these are things that I recall that really changed the way I see things. The other is shadows, which is some of the really sad parts that I recall. Somebody said to me, we did a little interview a couple days ago live, and she said, you know, even the most tragic things, I respect the way that you didn't descend into like maudlinness and kept some ray of hope in there. You know, it's not just a giving up or just a swath of grief on the page, hopefully. And the other sort of technical category is teachers. And that's not only the human beings, but there have been many that have really changed the course of my life, whether they know it or not, but also just tiny little experiences that I was taught something very fundamental by. There was another fourth section called Notes to Self, which I'd written kind of in the third person, you know, like a person speaking to oneself. And it was decided, you know, my publisher and I, her name is Gretchen Young at her new press, Regalo Press, which she's an amazing person. And she said, you know, it might be best to think about sort of peppering those, you know, somewhat randomly through those other sections. And I think it adds a nice texture.
Yes, it does. It does. So when you were writing these, like you said, there's no through story, no through line. So just walk me through like the process. Like you said, okay, today I want to talk about this time in my life or this insight, or how did these concepts and ideas come up for you?
You know, I've been for many years, I mean, what I do is mostly as a songwriter. So I found that having a clear idea of I'm going to write about such and such, which sometimes I do and feel I need to do, but it's not the best way for me. The best way for me is to sit with not an idea, but a fulsome desire to create something. Mm-hmm. And I do a lot of songwriting teaching, if you can even call that a possibility, not so much in terms of the harmony in parts of it, because you can get that anywhere, but just in terms of like unearthing something that is surprising to the writer, him or herself. So my process is, I like to do this because it makes me feel good. I write a lot. And I'll sit down and I'll take my iPhone and I'll set the timer for 7 minutes. And the reason I do that is if I have nothing to say, which generally I don't when I begin, 1 minute is no good because you can't get anything, you can't even get an idea down. A half hour is too long to sit in the shame and ignominy of like having nothing to say, but 7 minutes seems to me to be the sweet spot. So the success rate, and I'm not saying that I'm coming up with anything amazing necessarily, but the success rate for getting to the place where I'm involved in writing and possibly finishing something and editing it later is extremely high for me. It's about 85 to 90%. It's almost like the 7 minutes gets the plane going down the runway and it takes off, and almost invariably the alarm goes off, like shut off the alarm and I keep going. I'm pretty friendly with Kenneth Turan, who's the movie editor for the LA Times. He's just a all-time journalist. And he told me he taught a class, I think it was at USC. I don't know if it was quite like this, but this is how he said. He said, look, I came into the class. I was like, you know, they just brought me in for a day. And all the students thought maybe I would give them this big lecture. I said, sit in the chair, shut up, and write. And it seems like a sort of, you know, simple and stupid and glib thing to say, but there's so much truth in it.
Yes.
You will find out what you're writing and what you need to write only by getting in the process. It's like, how do you be in a relationship? You know, I've been married for 40 years. You sit together. You're with one another. There's no substitute for that.
Wow. I love that. You'll find out what you want to write about by getting into the process.
Yeah, and not, I mean, you can do it beforehand, and many people do, I do it as well, but I've found from what I like my results to be, and the ones that please me the most, they most often result from this sense of surprise and discovery.
So when you sit down, do you say, are you like, today I'm going to write an essay, today I'm going to write a song, today I'm going to write a poem, or do you discover that as you go to?
You know, there is a clearer sense of the form. You know, when I'm writing songs, I'm really in song mode. I write on Substack, so there's a lot of essays that I do, and I have this compulsion to like say something in a longer form in an essay. So those categories are somewhat mapped out for me when I sit down.
Okay.
I write a lot on airplanes because I fly a lot, and I find that that's a really good second time for me to write, especially when there was no internet. But now I like to, like, you know, but I have the ability to shut it off.
And right,
I know the technology enough to shut it down.
Well, I'm too cheap to pay for internet on the plane, so.
Well, now on Delta, it's free.
You know? Oh, no.
Well, yeah, so it,
no,
makes,
that's
it, it
great,
makes it harder.
But, yeah. Yeah, so on the, so with all the people around, the, do you wear noise canceling headphones, or
no,
you just
no,
block it
I
out?
No, I think when I get into it, like I wrote a few songs. I have a new album coming out in a couple of weeks, whatever that means these days.
Yeah,
it's called, yeah, well, I mean, it goes out on digital services, and now people, I can hear it in my car. It's great. And you make about as much, enough money to take your family out to a couple good meals each year from that.
Does anybody actually make any physical form of it anymore?
Well, yeah, I do. I put out some vinyl.
Okay.
But it's like saying the Model T has come and now Teslas are here. Does anyone ride horses? Of course they do.
Yes.
You know, but it's not the same.
It's not for the purpose of transportation.
No, it's just a thing. You know, it's a cool little riff. You know,
yeah,
it's not going to replace
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Man, to be honest, I don't listen to music as much as I used to when.
Well, that's this is it. The reason that I became a little bit more interested in writing books and writing, I guess ultimately anybody that puts out anything into the world, you know, wants to say something. You know, I'm sort of a languorous type. Since I was a little kid, I had a lot to say. And the desire is to be heard, but I'm putting out this record. It's really good. It's called At the Emergence of Stars. But I do know that almost no one will listen to it as I intended it to be. An album is a collection. That's what the album means. We've forgotten what that means. And it's intended to listen to it with some coherence between the tracks. It won't be. The thing about a book, aside from its incredible importance as something tangible, which is irreplaceable for human beings. Everybody's driving us to the digital world and we're suffering for it. But you can hold a thing. Let's not forget we're not intellects in saline solution at this point. But more than that, I have a confidence that people will read this, whether it's in one sitting or this book could be picked up here and there, as I intended it to be
right.
read.
Right. Yeah, I'm old enough to know when vinyl was it and how exciting it was to get cassette tapes and how we would wait by the radio for our favorite song to play and hit record on the tape to be able
to. Same exact thing.
I had this little round green radio. On a chain.
The funny thing is about that, at the time, and we laugh at it now, but at no time do we ever laugh at the technology that arises. My dad used to own an 8-track cassette place. It was called Taperama in Minneapolis.
I read about that in your book, and it took me back to the grassroots on 8-track.
And you know that, yeah, the grassroots, I love it. And at no time did we scoff and mock at the A-track. This was like, I can have amazing sound music of my own choice, except for that little delay that always happened when it kind of rewound, in my own car. It was fantastic. Yeah. We didn't laugh at the iPhone. I'm not laughing at this, but in 2 years, they're going to have something that makes this obsolete.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's... So you know, like I said, I went cassette, 8-track. Maybe were the 8... No, cassettes were... I had cassettes before 8-track. The going from that to CD was a big thing. And then I did get an iPod and transferred all my CDs or a lot of my CDs onto yeah. the iPod. I don't even know where that thing is anymore. And now, you know, I know how to use. I mean, I've been using computers since 1981. I have probably bought 100 computers in my life. I'm very computer
literate. Right.
And I mean, I used to be able to take them apart and add the memory myself. And,
oh, wow. That's deep.
Yeah. And I programmed a whole general ledger system off of DBase. You know, I'm very technically savvy, but I just haven't gotten into basically streaming music. It just...
You know, I got it, not because I'm protesting it or anything. I got into it relatively recently, which is, you know, and what I found is knowing that I can listen to any possible thing I ever want, I find myself very often not knowing what to choose.
Well, there's that. Yeah.
And I go back to, like, you know, I'm on a Wayne Shorter kick right now, and I love early blues, so mm-hmm. I can always go back to that. But, like, there's when there's scarcity, as we well know, there's value.
Yeah.
When there's everything, there's a lack of sense of value. And that's the other thing that happened to music. That's why we used to listen to music together. A new record would come out by Stevie Wonder and people would, like, let's have a party and listen in communion. That's totally done. It's an isolated experience now.
Yeah, unless you go to live music, which I live part-time yeah. in Austin, so I get, you know,
yeah,
there's
so that's
a lot of
it,
that around.
For sure.
But yeah. But and here too in our little town of Fairfield, Iowa, we have some great live music venues here. So then you get, but then COVID kind of undermined that for a while too.
For a while, yeah. I mean, people long to be together. They long for physical things. They long for things that elevate them. And they are looking, look, when you pick up a book or you go to a show, a concert, or even a movie, I think what you're looking for, without maybe using these terms, you're looking for some form of transcendence. You're looking to, especially in a music show, you're looking for a spiritual experience. You're looking to leave, in some metaphorical sense, your physical body, your routines, your rote way of looking at the world. That's the job of the artist. And when I play with some of the greatest musicians who are way better than me, which is always a good thing to do. And we talk about that, not in a treacly way, but, like, you know, this is kind of our role here tonight. It's serious business.
Why don't you read a little bit from the book for us, Peter?
Yeah, I'll start out with a shorter one. This is kind of how I decided to open the book. At the last minute, this one I'm going to read was the end, and I took what was going to be the beginning and put it at the end. And I thought, I'm happy I did this. It was one of those calls to the publisher, like in the 11th of the 11th hours. This is called Still on the Road. Returning home anytime soon is impossible. We are spirits, after all, sent down to inhabit delicate bodies. Bodies that, for all our efforts, remain tethered to a desire for the fleeting things. One day, we think, we will sate this unbearable hunger, slake this unbearable thirst, We are staggering angels forever on a quest to unveil the point of our sojourns. The difficulty of our doing so lies in the fact that each day we move through a place and time which swears that there never was a point and that there never will be one. This notion is especially difficult for those of us who are still on the road, still dreaming up songs to tell the world otherwise.
And that's Peter Himmelman writing, reading from Suspended by No String. Now, you've got these little drawings peppered throughout here, too. Mm-hmm. You want to tell me a little bit about those?
Yeah, I mean, I like to draw, so I thought, well, what if I add a couple drawings to this book? Little pen and ink. I don't know if you remember, like, James Thurber used to have drawings, and it sounded like a good idea. And this editor I mentioned, Barbara Clark, she said, well, if you do that, I think you should make drawings for every piece. So I don't know how many, it's like 160 little drawings that I did, but I think they, for me, they have a very valuable purpose, because some of the pieces are very heavy and they lighten them. And some of the pieces that are lighter, they add a little bit more poignance. They're just tiny sort of, you'd have to sort of search the piece to find the relationship to the drawing in some of these. A little obscure mention of a shoe somewhere comes out as a drawing, a little drawing of a shoe.
So the drawing for this piece was an angel weighted down?
Yeah, sort of tethered to
the
ground.
Tethered to the earth, yeah. Wow. Now, do you ever, like this piece could be a song too?
Yeah, it's not written, you know, songs generally, it's not a total fast rule, but they have a very particular architecture.
Bridge, you know, now verse, yeah, chorus, I mean, verse, chorus, bridge.
Yeah. I mean, it's really like looking at the blues form, which is a line, you repeat the line, and the third one is kind of a call to those two lines. It's extraordinarily constrained, like a haiku poem. Mm. But the power, and no one can really deduce what the nature of that power is, but to veer from the form, you also then don't allow yourself, you know, the value of that structure. And that's the way that songs are. Songs are, you want to go on a little trip, but you want to always come back to home and then leave. And in the bridge, which is a great opportunity, I don't always write bridges, but that's an opportunity to see the same situation or feeling from a completely different vantage point. And then you return home. And the chorus is sort of a succinct declaration of what you've been saying. I mean, not hard and fast rules, because I'm just making this up now.
Right,
No one's ever asked me these good of questions before, so... You know, I got to say that.
Well, I did a little songwriting in my past.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see the verse chorus.
Yeah, you know. Yeah. And you know, the fact you've released how many albums?
Oh, I've put out a lot of kids' records. I don't know, like
dozens.
30 records or something.
Wow.
Yeah, a lot.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And Do you have songs that you have written that never made it to a record?
Oh God! Oh yeah, I have. In addition to those records, I have 10 or 11 volumes of these things called Himmel Vaults, and each one has like 12 songs. And even for this recent record, I didn't go to the Himmel Vaults, but I had like 40 songs that were just kind of there. Those come from those periods when I'm just writing and writing, and I get on I'm sure my wife knows I'm on a kind of a manic streak, and they're just coming and coming, and then they sort of stop for a while. So I like to catch them, you know, with the butterflies when they're out.
when you write like a short essay like this, how much editing do you do?
There's always some, and there's always some in a song, but you know, when you do a short thing, it's like you threw the clay down and you made a pot, and the form of the pot is there. If you can only do so much, you can put some designs on, but if you don't like it, you have to start all over again. So this one probably was some light editing. I mean, I'm not so patient that it takes me years to do things. You know, it's just my impatience is like, if it isn't happening, I'll just go on to something else that is. You know, there's a big backlog of like spare parts.
Have you ever considered writing something in long form?
I have, and it's just
like,
you know, why
it could be an opera.
This doesn't qualify. I wrote a cycle of songs for an album I put out on Sony Epic in 1994. It was a record called Skin. And it was being looked at. An agent in Los Angeles was, a big young Turk agent was. This was a time that Tommy, the rock opera, was around.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in the process of bringing it, trying to bring it, at least the first stages of bringing it to Broadway. And unfortunately, perhaps, you know, I certainly unfortunately for him, I think he OD'd. And that was the end of that. And maybe fortunately for me, maybe that would have been the great thing for me to do. But when you say, have I thought about a long form, that would be a novel. And the reason it's so intimidating for me, and it is because I've never once sat down and written one line toward that end.
Oh, wow.
And maybe you just put a seed in me because, yeah, I know for a fact things are most intimidating when they're just hanging out in the future. And all you can see is how daunting they might be.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think you'd be a great novelist.
Well, look, you know, this is a life-changing show for me. I'm going to tell you right away. I'm feeling good about it.
Great. Well, Peter, would you read the title essay from Suspended by No String? You know, when I was a kid, I had trouble saying my S's. And so for some reason, that word suspended trips me up a little bit.
Okay, so we've got something in common. I had what they called a lateral lisp, where I'd say snakes.
Oh.
And I didn't really think much was wrong with it, but they brought me into the speech teacher in like whatever second grade. And they said, just say snakes. And I was cured. I don't know if it was a cure, but that was it. So,
and
yeah.
Actually, I had more trouble with R's, I think. I had the most trouble with R's. And I was so embarrassed at being sent out for speech therapy in like second, third grade that I made up the story that I was being – that I went to some special thing for smart kids.
Absolutely, and you probably did. You weren't off on that. Right, let me find this page. Oh, here it is. This is a little bit longer read. I hope I don't like mess up the words, but if I do, there's no editing, and I don't want there to be.
Okay, all right.
Okay, so this is one of the notes to self where I'm using the you voice. Suspended by no string. You wake from a fitful sleep. It's just past 3 a.m., and with your last dream all but forgotten, you look up at the moon-cast patterns on the ceilings and the wall. You're thirsty. You walk downstairs. A light from a small fixture glows near the ceiling above the landing. Your head feels strange, not dizzy, just different. You wonder if you're coming down with something. You've gone downstairs for a drink of water, that's all. You felt one of the most familiar, most primitive sensations, the machine of your body telling you that you need more fluids to stay alive. Only your thirst is present. In some way, you become devoid of knowledge. It's not that you don't know things, random facts, names of people and places, makes of automobiles, Joaquin, Boston, Lincoln Continental. You haven't forgotten those. But what you now believe is that the miracle of your having been born is something you can no longer ignore. Most mornings you get up thinking, today's the day I'll win something or make something or meet someone or stumble upon something so significant that it'll change everything. But as always, the day comes and it passes. You read the news, you make your phone calls, and you have your meetings. Later, you see your spouse and your children, and you feel a glimmer of something akin to love, but mostly you're tired. And at night, when you lie in bed, you're hoping that what you were looking for today, you will find tomorrow. And so up until this moment at the bottom of the stairs, in a small but real way, you've been waiting to die. No, of course not. You don't want to die. But you also feel that you've been waiting for this all to end. You look up at the fan above your kitchen table and watch it spin. You are suddenly startled by your ability to see. You can scarcely process what this means, but you try. I, the me inside me, you think, the I that maintains its conception of being an individuated someone, am absorbing my physical surroundings by means of these moist gelatinous balls that fit perfectly into the sockets in the front of my skull. To no one you say, why have I never noticed this? It's not as if you haven't noticed or seen it before. It's just that now seeing, your ability to see, strikes you as a magnificent power, a miraculous faculty that went unnoticed until this very moment because it's always present. Over time, you became inured to the power of your own sight. You move to the sink. You lift the handle of the faucet and watch as water pours out. You are struck by how mysterious and beautiful water is as it flows into the sink, beautiful enough to make you weep. Yes, you've broken down in tears, and you muffle the sound with your hand so that no one in your house wakes up in the middle of the night thinking that some terrible thing happened that made you cry here all alone in the dark. But you're not sad, are you? Your joy is beyond the ability of words to express, and so you cry. Tears are what happen when we arrive at the edge of our language. You are there now, standing on that edge, and you cup your hands under the stream and bring the water to your lips. You drink and ascend in joy with each swallow. You are overwhelmed by water. Drinking water seems at this very moment like one of the most profound experiences you've ever had. And you wonder, just who is it that's experiencing all this? There's a window, the one over the sink. You look outside. You see mostly darkness, and the darkness itself calls you, asks you to move into it and to enter it somehow. You walk outside. When you look up at the sky, you see the same stars you've seen since you were a child. But now, unlike every other time you've seen those stars, except when you first saw them as a child, they make you shiver with awe. They are a thing you think so wondrous that words are not strong enough for the telling. You walk farther out onto the grass and say out loud, as if in prayer, I've been searching all my life for something to break the monotony, to heal me of my uncertainty, of my anxiousness, of my nagging sense that there is no purpose, no design, no miracle, no thing that's mystical or truly beautiful. But now somehow you've found it. And this knowledge comes without words. It is a dance that's lodged into your muscle memory, a dance that alludes to, that hints at, that points toward these truths. The cool grass on your toes and under the soles of your feet, the sound of night birds, the swallow and the heavy great horned owl, the trilling of the crickets as they call for mates in the windless summer air, the smell of jasmine wafting from all sides, dreamy and full, the roar of jets tiny in the vast reaches of the sky, moving in from the ocean, laden with travelers asleep and dreaming as they rocket home to loved ones or to empty rooms. Here under the darkened firmament, you are no more and no less than what everyone on earth has always been, a naked and fragile figure suffused with an immutable spirit, propelling yourself here and there, communicating your innermost thoughts, inclined toward both love and war, sex and prayer, spilling blood and bringing soup to the poor, and all the while breathing, as if the very act of breathing were a supplication, a plea to touch the face of God as he appears down in silent wonder at his creation. Now, with your thirst finally slaked, you have come to appreciate what you've never allowed yourself to know and may never have expected was there to know, that being alive on this perfectly round blue planet, suspended by no string and spinning in the black void of space, is enough.
Thank you, Peter. That was Peter Himmelman reading from Suspended by No String. Peter, do you think that everyone has those moments, but we just forget them, we block them out?
I think that everybody has those moments. I think those moments are what make up infancy and early childhood. Mm. And then they are wrested away as being unusual and not important. And, you know, we need to get on with things. We need to stop at the red light. We need to know how to use our credit card and cross the street. So those things are invaluable. But in the process of becoming, quote, normal person, we've thrown away this elemental part of ourselves, which is this ability to sense the miracle of our aliveness, which is really the, if I had to say there was a conceit of this book, it would be that. It was for me to categorize, itemize certain things, just a tiny bit of the things in my life that have brought me closer toward that understanding. For me, that sense of awe has come. We just had two new grandsons to add to our collection in 3 weeks.
And oh,
so
my.
Those kinds of things will put you in those moods. Conversely, things that are the polar opposite of that, and those are not things that we wish or pray for, they will put you in that mood. There are certain rarefied times where you just look at somebody. As I said, I've been married, you know, for almost 40 years, but there are times when you do, and they're very rare, when your sense of appreciation and love is so heightened. And those moments, which are not continuous, not in this form of our being, but they can be indelible. They can be flashpoints and little touchstones. And I think that every person has those. And to whomever is listening, you know, don't hide those away. Those are you, and they are your fundamental strengths in life. Your strengths aren't your talents, your mastery. Those are great tools. Your strength is your cognizance of your aliveness, of your humanity. You don't need courage or confidence. You simply understand that you're a unique individual that was put here for a unique purpose. And all the confidence in the world becomes irrelevant.
You know, as I was listening to you read that, I flashed back to a time when I was just walking down the street and suddenly felt this feeling of being immensely in love. And I'm like, oh, I'm not in a relationship. I don't have anyone that this love is focused on. And yet it felt like
I know what you mean. It might be, although I'm, you know, do think there's a very strong need for particularity in love. There is this form of love, and I've had that experience where it's not pointed at anything in particular. It's almost like, you know, to relate what I was saying about writing a song, it's not directed. It kind of, because it isn't named, it has the ability to grow larger. And because you're writing in metaphor, perhaps, people can take what they want from it. But that's a very elevated experience that you had.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure because you remember it, it becomes part of you.
I remember it, and yet I forget it all the time. Something has
because yeah. you know, I'm answering emails and doing things, and this human nature in this stage of our, quote, evolution is such that those moments are like little pinpoints that are filled with little light, but there's so few. I mean, I'm a very observant Jew. And one of the goals, as I see it, of my faith is to open one's whole life so that the pinpoints become a whole. Mm-hmm. And it's not something that's achievable. It's not like I do that. My pinpoints, I probably have two of them. And I'm not an expert on any of this stuff, by the way.
I think you have more than two. You've written about more than two in here.
Well, in terms of like maintaining this, I'm anxious person. I tend towards, you know, being a little bit depressed.
Well, you know,
I'm not a.
I've always thought there's a fine line between sort of enlightenment and mental illness.
For sure. I mean, studies of creativity, and because it's very, it's not subjective. The things that I think about, well, this is just leading me in a little bit of a tangent. The people that write or paint or dance or sing or whatever they do for a living, what they're doing creates a responsibility in them. And I'm sure you know this, you're taking a lot of time just to kind of think about things. I was once with this really incredible artist, and I, for some reason, I'm blanking on his name, it should come to me later. And he was an older man who was a sculptor and a painter, and he had things in the MoMA. And he invited me to his studio, and he was kind of on a couch, sort of laying down, and he's got all these different projects in motion. And I said, so like, you know, how do you organize your time? What do you do all day? He said, well, what do you do all day? And I was thinking about, well, I started listening to Joan Jett, and I went down a Joan Jett rabbit hole, and I grabbed my guitar and started like, you know, playing some chords or, sounded like that. And then I read some history book about military history. And then I got on the phone with my agent. And then he said, yeah, that's exactly what I did today. And I'm like a fireman, he said. When there's a job to do, I go down the fireman's pole and I get it done in a very methodical way. But much of the time, I'm just kind of collecting things, you know, collecting things to assemble and perhaps use one day.
Hmm. And that's hard for a lot of people to accept that that's okay, because we've been told you should be productive every day.
I am definitely in that mode where I'm trying to have to unlearn this stuff and just go with it And also not to think that that tendency in me was slothful.
Exactly.
That's the first thing that came to mind because, you know, we're Americans. We were doers and we, you know, need to do.
Yeah.
And I mean, we still need to do, but like there's a, you know, priority.
Or at sometimes instead of doing, we can just be.
Yeah. Yeah, that's hard for me.
That's hard.
Real hard. I would say pretty impossible.
So, Peter, tell me a little bit about the Big Muse.
Yeah, this is something that right as the music business was falling off the cliff in around 2008 or 9, a lot of my kids were about to go away to private colleges. And I thought, well, this is going to be perhaps, you know, I need something else. I'm always looking ahead. You know, a freelance person is always thinking about where the next check is going to come really to sustain this childlike activity. It's kind of it's a need. You know, you're sort of tricking something. Tricking society.
And so you got one over on the man.
Yeah, that's it. You know, you got one over, you know. And so I was thinking, well, what is it that I know from, you know, touring around for all these years, from writing these songs, from working, you know, in a leadership sense with all these different bands and performing? Could this be used in a business context? And I called some business people and I came up with this little plan. There was a company in Texas called NewTek and they, you know, incredible. They've like CGI, I think they invented from there. And I said, look, what would you think if I flew down, you know, to completely gratis and did a session for your whole team, which would, in ways kind of unlock their creativity. And they said, yeah, we'll fly you down. And they had the entire company, even the people, you know, did the shipping, which I thought was great. I was so nervous before that thing that I didn't sleep for probably 3 nights. And I flew in the night before, literally not sleep. And then I just went at it. And the sort of the idea was to personify the internal critic, and I didn't have a name for it at that early stage, that when you're trying to write something or do something or have a difficult phone call, we all know that voice, you know, even now before the show, like, Peter, who cares about what you have to say? You're coming on, you know, as this rock guy, but compared to Springsteen, you're nothing. And it tells you this voice. And I sort of reasoned that the voice isn't trying to diminish you. It's trying to save your life. And let me explain how that works. It's part of the amygdala. And it's powerful enough to stop you from your deepest dreams and hopes. We all know that. It's not a funny thing. And the reason it does that, and I later gave it the name MARV, which is an acronym for majorly afraid of revealing vulnerability. MARV's duty is a part of our brain, you know, neurochemistry, is to prevent you from getting killed by a puma or in war or any tragic circumstance. So how does MARV interpret me coming up and reading a poem, let's say, if that I'm not familiar with that? MARV says the night before or the weeks or months before, Peter, if you get up there and read this poem, there's a very good chance you will fail. And I'm like nodding my head, affirming what it's saying, because he's right. He's factual, he's just as smart as we are. And if you fail, you will experience something that's anathema to all humanity. Shame. And like, you're right, and I'm nodding my head. And if you experience shame, what is the result of shame? A shameful person is shunned and abandoned. And what is the result of abandonment, given that you are still the same young child looking out the same two eyes? Nothing much has changed, except you have underarm hair and credit cards. What would abandonment have meant? It meant that you would die, and none of us can live outside of society. And no, though we don't go through that list and we don't have, you know, clear cognition about that, that is essentially what stops us from doing the most important things in our lives. Telling somebody how much you love them, for example, is very difficult for people, because if you're going to fail in that and be shunned, you'll be devastated. So I went through this little course with them, and kind of the hook of the course was that I would have everyone writing songs, the lyrics, according to a very set structure. I was using Hank Williams' Cold, Cold Heart as a really clean structure, which has this incredible Ghost in the Machine. If you use it, everything you say is powerful. It's where the title becomes the final words of the stanza, the four-line stanza. It's like Comfortably Numb or Tangled Up in Blue. There's millions of songs like that. And if you accede to the form, it's easy to write a beautiful thing. So I'd go and I would, you know, come with my guitar and sing the song. And later, you know, I've been doing this thing all over the world. So we come with like a band. We do this in front of 1,500 people. There's no size too small or too large. And I really enjoy it. I really, along with making my own stuff, I really enjoy, this is probably one of the things you get to in adulthood, I really enjoy helping other people get to what they really want to do, and particularly not only young people, but everybody.
So you're still doing this?
Yeah.
And like how often do you
give
less these?
Less now, and much less after COVID began. That would really knock the wind out of its sails. And now a lot of teams are like, you know, they're not together. I did a number of these things online, which really work, but again, nothing can replicate being in person.
Right. Well, Peter, I think we have time for you to read one more short piece.
Sure.
And then we'll have to wrap up.
I'm going to read the end, which was going to be the beginning.
Okay.
And now it works better as the end. So this is called Drive-In Movie. The lakes and ponds have swelled with the recent rains. The air is redolent with the warring scents of ripening crab apples and blue-green algae. Tonight, my parents will take my brother Paul, my sisters Nina and Susie, and me to a drive-in movie. We will ride in the banged-up Ford pickup my father brought home last week. We will climb into the bed of the truck, which he has covered in sleeping bags, and in the languid heat of a midsummer Minnesota evening, my father will rev the engine and the truck will begin to roll. Out in the open road, the four of us will lie on our backs and watch the stars slowly appear as a reluctant sun lowers itself behind the gently rolling hills west of Lake Minnetonka. The movie will have already begun by the time we arrive. When my father finally makes his way back to the truck with the popcorn and the Heyer's root beer, I will be fast asleep. I will wake up the next morning in my own bed, staring into faint swirls of dust inside a beam of clear sunlight. And just as I have no memory of my spirit descending to this earthly plane on the day I was born, I will have no memory of having been carried to bed in the strong arms of my father the night before.
Beautiful. Thank you, Peter Himmelman, Suspended by No String. For our closing quote today, I found one from Maharishi Mahesh Yogi that is a reflection of the opening quote in your book. Do not fight the darkness, let the light in and the darkness will disappear.
Amen to that, sister.
And see you all next week on Writer's Voices.